This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. French legislative elections took place this past week, and the party of France's new president, Emmanuel Macron, received a sizable majority in the French parliament. So Macron is going to be operating from a nice position of power going forward. What does this mean for France and for the European Union? We're going to talk to Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. Second, we are going to look at a couple of incidents that took place this past Sunday that escalated tension between the United States and Iran. A U.S. jet shot a Syrian jet out of the sky, and Iran launched some missiles into Syrian territory against the Islamic State. Both of these were the first time that these respective countries had made these kinds of aggressive moves in quite some time. And we're going to talk with Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal to help us to put these events in their context and in the context of what's been happening more broadly in the last couple of months between the United States and Iran. And we'll talk about what we can expect to happen going forward. Then we're going to look at some evidence that rich people are selfish jerks. You might remember some studies that came out a few years back making this claim based on scientific research. Well, the media loved the narrative that rich people are rich because they're selfish. More recent research casts doubt on the results of those studies. It actually points to a different conclusion. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this new research and some lessons that we can draw from it. And I'll finish off the program today just reminiscing a little bit about this past Father's Day and giving a reminder of just how important it is to be a dad. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. What has happened in France in the last couple of months is quite extraordinary. Just a year ago, a man founded a brand new political party, and on May 7th, he became president. And now, with legislative elections this past week, his new party has won 360 seats of the 577 in the French legislature. This is one of the largest legislative majorities in France's history. It really gives an intriguing picture of the state of France today, and it also raises the question about where the new president, Emmanuel Macron, will take France, what he's going to also do to help the European project generally. To talk about this, we have from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So, first of all, what points do you take from Macron's success in the presidential elections and then specifically the legislative elections?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways his success, well, it surprised me. I certainly didn't. I expected him to have a lot more trouble in getting a majority from a brand new party. And now you're just faced with this situation where whole swathes of traditions of the old guard, of established politicians, have been booted out. Traditional parties have kind of been reduced to the almost minor parties, and you've got this party full of people brand new to politics taking their place. So I think it shows an enormous dissatisfaction with the current way of French politics and the way politics is run. And I think the other thing that really shows the dissatisfaction there and actually gives a kind of a hint to further trouble is the turnout figures. So you've got this huge and an unusual majority for Macron. At the same time, this election set records for low turnout for legislative elections. It's the first time ever that turnout has fallen below 50%. So it doesn't necessarily point to just this huge level of enthusiasm for Macron's new party as it does for just a huge level of dissatisfaction with French politics.
Yeah, how much do you think it seemed like France and Europe collectively kind of breathed a sigh of relief when Macron won over Le Pen in the presidential election? And there was I just wonder how much the legislative election results represent a kind of surge of relief and say a certain amount of, yes, this is definitely the direction that we want to go. French voters basically putting a stamp of enthusiasm behind the way that that election, the presidential election went.
Perhaps, though, I think it'd be hard to say a stamp of enthusiasm for when the turnout is so low. I guess it's, in some ways, Macron represents the best of both worlds. If you're dissatisfied with French politics, you may want to go with someone entirely new. One of those options is Le Pen, and go for someone who's completely beyond the pale, and a lot of people went for Le Pen. But Macron represents, he's a way to, you know, he's kind of got this image, a lot of that is just image, but this image of being an outsider. Many in his party and in his parliament are certainly outsiders. So he's got this same kind of outsider image that Le Pen has, without at the same time having all that baggage with anti-Semitism and just fairly extreme policies. So they can kind of still stick with, you know, I think the dissatisfaction in terms of politics, it's more about leadership and character than it is about specific policies. So they can stick with, say, the middle ground that they're more comfortable with, while at the same time say we're going to clear out those old corrupt elite that we can't stand anymore and invite in a new broom. Of course, the big danger of that is if Macron fails, if he doesn't deliver on the hopes of those that did vote for him, well, then the next step is to go to the real outsider, Marine Le Pen.
Right. So, well, let's talk about his credentials as an outsider. Kind of implying that he may not be as much of an outsider as he seems. Some have actually said that that's really a kind of a pretense or an illusion. So what can you tell us about him and what he actually represents?
Right. I mean, in terms of his background, he is well and truly a member of the elite. He's been the economy minister in the government. He served at the high levels of the civil service. He's been an investment banker, Secretary General of the LSC. Melanie Phillips called him the ultimate insider. She wrote that his claims to represent a challenge to the existing order, like his purported centralism, is phony. So he's not this complete, you know, outsider in the way that Le Pen is. And as to his policies, I mean, for the longest time, I hated calling him a centralist, because he's not. He's pretty left-wing. But then again, when it comes to French politics, where the entire French political system is quite far to the left, then, okay, maybe it is fair to call him a centralist. He does want to do a lot of things that will have the trade union, the very powerful trade union bloc in France, screaming blue murder. He does want to liberalize a lot of France's economy and its very restrictive labor laws. Now, there's still a lot of discussion as to how far he wants to go, how far he'll actually manage to go. But he does want to bring some freedom to the very statist French economy.
So given the fact that he now has a very strong legislative majority that seems to give him a considerable mandate and quite a lot of impetus to implement whatever policies that he would like to, you mentioned a few specifics there. What do we expect to happen within France as he begins to implement his policies?
Right. Well, his grand vision is basically a big two-step plan. And the long-range vision that he has is more about the European Union. He's very much a pro-EU candidate, and he believes, correctly, really, in my view, that the European Union cannot function the way it is now. He's likened the current state of the European Union as being half pregnant. You can't be half pregnant. Mm-hmm. You can't have this halfway house towards being a super state. You've either got to become a fully super state, full super state, where you share a lot of sovereignty and tax revenue, or you've got to go back to being a group of nations with their own different currencies. Mm-hmm. And so
this is really something that we haven't seen so much from France recently. It seems like the relationship between Germany and France has been a bit strained in recent years, and this could accelerate the unification?
Well, yes, because I think other French presidents have had that same goal, but a different way of getting there. For example, I think François Hollande wanted something similar, but he wanted something similar by fighting Germany. Mm. He wanted to get that kind of European Union that he wanted by, early on in his presidency, he talked about trying to form an alliance of southern European countries, standing up to Germany, and, doing it over Germany's dead body, basically. And that failed. He was defeated by Germany. He never really got that southern alliance off the ground, and that didn't work. The key difference with Macron is he has a completely different approach. He says, actually, his goal is, that's his second step, and it's similar in some ways to what Hollande wanted. But instead, he wants to say, okay, well, Germany's told us they're not going to give us that while we're in this big economic mess. They don't want to be saddled with being in this super state with a dysfunctional French economy. They don't want to be perpetually sending bailouts to France. At the moment, they don't feel like they can trust France with the German credit card, for example. They're worried that if they have any kind of super state, France will borrow money like crazy and then just rely on Germany to pick up the tab. And so Macron's response is to, in some ways, call Germany's bluff and say, okay, Germany, we'll make the changes that you want. I've got this strong majority now, and he set out to get the strong majority with that in end. And, yes, these changes are going to be very difficult to France to make, but we've got this strong economy. We're going to do that. We're going to get right to work doing that. And then we're going to turn around to Germany and say, okay, we did what you wanted. Now hold up your part of the bargain and let's come together and get this super state going. And I think that way of doing it has much bigger chance of success than what Hollande was going for.
So really the relationship between France and Germany could be strengthened considerably under a Macron presidency. And it seems like in a lot of ways, Germany has to be looking at this situation and feel a considerable impetus to try to make what Macron is suggesting work, because I guess you look at the results of the French presidential election, you see how close, in some ways, how close Marine Le Pen came to taking power. And there certainly is that dissatisfaction among French voters that you were talking about, and a no small percentage of the French electorate that would seek a direction that Germany would be really upset about. And so here it's almost like you see this window of opportunity that has opened up for those who want a stronger European Union, a stronger Eurozone, a stronger European economy to move forward.
That's definitely right. And that's exactly the way that Germany is looking at it. I think in a lot of ways they don't necessarily want to make the changes that Macron is talking about. It's a very hard sell. Even if Macron were to make those changes, it's a very hard sell domestically to share the German credit card with other nations. If you going for closer cooperation, it means that the German economy is risked on the behavior of other nations. And fundamentally, that's not popular in Germany. So they don't necessarily want to. But if the choice is that, or you get President Marine Le Pen destroys the Eurozone, well, they would much rather that. And so that threat of Marine Le Pen is kind of omnipotent in the discussions that are going on with Germany. And so, yes, Germany has really welcomed Macron enthusiastically. The New York Times had an article just over the weekend talking about how Angela Merkel does not hide her enthusiasm for her new French partner. Writes, these days, the Paris-Berlin and Berlin-Paris flights have become crowded with civil servants heading to meetings. It writes about a new sense of urgency crossing the Rhine. And Mr. Macron's government, it writes, is openly German-friendly. Five of his members of his government speak fluent German. The German and French defense ministers, they both speak French and German, and they've been getting along well. And they've both been making a lot of pushes to get on together. And then the other thing that I think really adds to this window of opportunity is if the polls are correct, which is a big if right now, after the German elections, where a lot of this discussion really begins in earnest, I don't think Macron's going to push too hard on this until after the German elections. He'll kind of focus more at home first.
German elections in September.
September, that's right. And if the polls are correct, it will be an Angela Merkel will be back in the chancellorship very, very probably for the last time. It seems hard to imagine that she would even want to go beyond another term. And so she'll be sitting there not thinking about the German electorate as much, but thinking more about her legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, we just had the former German chancellor Helmut Kohl die this week. And yeah, that was building up the European Union. That's been a lot of his legacy. And he's kind of been remembered for a lot of that. And as well as, you know, his involvement in things like the reunification of Germany. That's what Angela Merkel is going to be thinking more and more about. And perhaps some of these concerns of the German voters about sharing the German credit card will weigh less on her mind than the risk of being going down in history as the German chancellor that destroyed the Eurozone. So I think that is also something that would perhaps help open that window of opportunity for the two to get along. Now, having said all that, I still don't think it's going to be easy. It still wouldn't surprise me, despite this closeness, if you do have some headbutting, because there are still core interests of both at stake. This is still going to be a hard sell at Germany. You know, if this was easy, it would have happened already.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may still take further crisis to kind of really get it over the hump. But you know, Germany has to do something. So at the very, you know, we're going to see something at least. Whether it's enough to take it all the way to a Eurozone superstate remains to be seen, but we're definitely, I think, going to see steps in that direction.
Well, if it does take further crisis, there would be plenty of candidates waiting in the wings to provide such crisis for Europe, if that's what it takes. And we're looking at this from a prophetic perspective that we talk about quite a lot, that we do expect unification to occur in a robust way, and yet still you see the prophecy of the composition of this project being iron and miry clay. It's not like it ever comes together in a cohesive way. There's always going to be these disparate elements that prevent it from really being cemented as strongly as something that would last for a long time. So we do see those elements certainly at play here, and it'll be interesting to watch how this unfolds under the Macron presidency and what happens after the German elections. That election could be interesting. And as you say, even if Angela Merkel remains in power, how does she begin to conduct herself maybe a little differently than she has in light of the fact that this may be her last term? Very interesting to watch. We appreciate you really brought a lot of good points out there for us, Richard. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer. He's writing an article about this subject. It's about to be published on thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. Thanks a lot, Richard. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We've been keeping a close eye on Iran and developments in the Middle East with its incursions into Syria and blows that have fallen against the Islamic State. Well, this past Sunday, confrontation between the United States and Iran seemed to lurch closer. First, for the first time in 20 years, a U.S. jet shot down an enemy aircraft in battle, a Syrian jet. Later that same day, Iran fired ballistic missiles at targets inside Syria. This is its first missile attack in 15 years out of abroad. And these were the latest incidents in what has become a quite regular direct conflict between America and Iran. And where is this leading? To talk about this, we have here in studio our Middle East analyst, trumpet writer Brent Noctegal. Hello, Brent.
Hello, thanks for having me with you.
So let's just talk about these two incidents on Sunday, and you could just give us the details of what happened here.
Yeah, so the jet, the fighter that was shot down by the U.S. jet, that took place just on the western side of Raqqa, the stronghold of the Islamic State inside central to eastern Syria. From northern Raqqa, you have American-backed Kurdish fighters that are pushing at the Islamic State from the north, and then from the east, you have the Syrian regime converging on that city as well. So you've got direct well, the potential for direct conflict between U.S. allies and Syria, or the Iranian allies there in the fight. And so what we saw was a Syrian jet just after the SDF, or this Kurdish force, fought against or took some territory back from the Islamic State in northern Raqqa. They were bombed by a Syrian jet, and the United States reacted almost instantaneously with some of its own jets that were in the sky and blew the Syrian jet. There hasn't been any talk of whether the pilot was killed or not, or whether he survived. But yeah, like you said in the introduction, this hasn't happened by an American jet fighting against an enemy in 20 years since the Balkan Wars. So this is quite a significant decision, basically saying Syrian regime, it doesn't matter anymore. If you attack one of our allies, we are going to take vengeance on you.
All right. And later that day, Iranian missiles, what was the provocation? What were they targeting?
Well, they used, they were targeting the Islamic State. Fired from some Western provinces of Iran across Iraqi territory. And they landed in one of the big cities of the Islamic State. And they say that this was a response to the attacks 2 weeks ago that the Islamic State had against the parliamentary building in Tehran.
Right.
So, and indeed, I mean, it could be, and this was a decent alibi for this missile attack.
Sure.
But just given the significance of this moment, considering the United States just attacking the Syrian jet and the ratcheting up of tensions that we've seen in eastern Syria over the past month between Iran and the United States, it was intended to send a message, and they even said as much, the Iranians, while we attack the Islamic State, we wanted Saudi Arabia and the United States to be the receivers of this message. The message being basically, we've been working on our ballistic missile program for the past 30 years. Yes, you might have sanctions against it, but we just use them in battle. And for some, this might be justification for Iran's ballistic missile program, the fact that they attack the Islamic State. No doubt they'll try and play it out that way. But it also shows the U.S. That they have that capability.
And they have their fingers pretty close to the trigger. I mean, if the United States knocks this jet out of the sky and these missiles are launched within hours, that's a pretty close response.
For sure, it definitely is, and it's just interesting to see the United States has kind of the United States, Russia, and now Iran have kind of used this same tactic to show that they are invested heavily in this fight. We remember it was Russia about a year ago when they fired cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea over Iran, over Iraq, and they landed against the Islamic State territory. And then you had Tomahawk cruise missiles being fired from the Mediterranean coast by the United States, announcing that Mr. Trump's all in and you better watch out if you do have a chemical attack or fight against our interest. Now the Iranians are saying, we can do that too. We can do that too. And all your troops and your interests are at a length or a distance that we can strike if we want to. These can travel up to, I think, 700 kilometers. If you can strike Syria, you can almost strike Israel. So obviously the Israelis are aware of this. There are some reports that they fired six and only one or two of them actually hit their target. Some of them fell down in Iraq, which I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case. But nevertheless, it does show that Iran is looking at this battle, in a looming battle in eastern Syria, and they're saying that we can bring all of our armaments to bear in this fight if we so choose.
Right. You mentioned the chemical attack that Bashar Assad launched and President Trump's response launching those missiles into Syrian territory. That was the beginning of April. And really, since that time, we've seen a considerable escalation in the amount of direct confrontation that you really could view it as a more direct intervention by the United States against Iran and Iran against the United States, or certainly Iranian and American interests. Maybe you could just catch us up to speed on just the escalation of tensions and direct conflict.
Yeah, it's very important to note this, and it would be understandable for listeners to just hear about more fighting in the Syrian civil war and be, well, nothing's changed for 6 years. But there has been marked change over the past month and a half, ever since that, well, I guess it was April, that strike by Mr. Trump that was ordered by him. Because up to that point, the Syrian regime and Iranian allies, such as Hezbollah and the other divisions inside Syria and Iraq, had not been targeted by the United States. As crazy as that might sound, it hadn't happened. The Syrian civil war was really arcing up right during the time that the nuclear deal was being worked out with the Obama administration in Iran. And they knew, Mr. Obama knew, and that's why we even had that red line that was not, that was crossed on the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian dictator, and the United States did nothing. They knew, the United States knew, that we couldn't push a deal through if we started attacking against Iranian interests in Iraq and Syria. And so we had nothing, no, for 4 or 5 years, no attacks from the United States against the man that was responsible for most of the deaths in Syria. We talk about this a lot, but the Islamic State is not the one that's causing the mass refugee crisis outside of Syria. That was already up and running because Assad was killing his own people. And a lot of the Islamic State gained fighters because they ended up fighting against Bashar al-Assad. So their ranks actually swelled because of the horrible and atrocious acts that Assad was perpetrating against his own people. So that was the first 4.5-5 years of the Syrian civil war. We have a new American administration. Mr. Trump says that basically that Iran, it looks like, is one of his major foreign policy goals, stopping Iran's march across the Middle East, hindering them in every way they can. Mr. Obama allowed Iran to flourish. We're going to push back on Iran. So he makes the decision to fire those cruise missiles, and it did announce a big change across the Middle East. U.S. is now going to support its allies in Syria. The U.S. is not going to stand idly by when Assad uses chemical weapons on his own people, and the U.S. is not going to stand by as well if Iran is trying to dominate the entire region from Afghanistan to the Mediterranean. They are going to start pushing back against that.
Well, you make a good point about, say, the conflict and the headlines that we see coming out of Syria right now, that there has been a change since April 4th, since April 6th, when President Trump ordered that missile strike on Syria. Take us through what are the things that are happening now, and how is this different? How does this reflect greater engagement on America's part?
Well, America's basically standing in the way of, on the Syrian-Iraqi border between Iranian-backed forces in Iraq and Syria. They're trying to link up. The United States doesn't want them to link up because they'll contain this large swath of territory. The Kurds in the north don't want this territory to be linked up underneath Iran's governance. So basically, you have the United States standing in the way and not budging and being willing to protect their allies and themselves. And we have seen Iranian provocations to test the waters over the past month, whether it be different Shiite groups that are approaching American bases in the region and see what they're going to do, or Iranian-made drones approaching U.S. soldiers that are over there, that dropping munitions on them, and seeing what the United States does. And so far, the United States has responded in every instance. I think we're up to 4 or 5 right now. Just today, or just yesterday, there was another Iranian-made drone that tried to attack U.S. forces that was shot out of the sky by U.S. forces. So what's interesting here is you have Iran that is not going to back down, and it looks like the United States is not going to back down. The reason this is happening again is because the Islamic State has lost territory. And so you're having these big world powers such as Russia, Syria, Iran, fighting in a smaller battle space. And who's going to govern the territory that the Islamic State loses? Iran's wanted to do that. That's why they're in this fight. have been in this fight against Islamic State because they wanted to gobble up this territory. Well, now the United States says we're not going to allow you. At least that's what it looks like.
Right. It's an interesting alignment of factors here with the Islamic State's decline and President Trump's arrival on the scene. It's those two together, it seems like. It's almost like a collision course that's just waiting to happen to escalate this.
Right. And that's what we said was going to happen. Everyone's rejoicing when the Islamic State is destroyed. And that is good and wonderful that they're wiped off the face of the earth because of what they've done. But the battle that comes after is more important geopolitically, has the potential to end up in many more lives lost, because it involves the world powers. It involves Russia. It involves Iran. Mm-hmm. It involves the United States. I mean, you've got Russian jets and American jets really close by to one another across right. those skies. You have Syrian jets that are doing the same thing. And it's what's been interesting in a way is just Russia's response to this, because they are the Syrian, one of the major Syrian allies. They came out and said that we're going to track United States aircraft now with our anti-aircraft installations anywhere across on the western part of the Euphrates. So most of central and western Syria, if United States jets come in those areas, we're going to be tracking them with our missile defense system, which big uptick. I don't think that Russia wants an escalation right now. Russia does not want to shoot an American jet out of the sky. It would be very foolish for them to do so. But they still have to kind of save face because they are, along with Iran, the Syrian regime's protector, apparently. And a Syrian jet gets knocked out of the sky, they've got to come out and at least do something. But I think that going forward, what's interesting with this situation is Eastern Syria, the Bible indicates, is going to be a line of tension between Iran and another world power. And what we're seeing right now is even though we've been fighting in the Middle East here for at least in the Syrian civil war for almost half a decade now, the battle is focused on this unimportant strip of land that the Bible indicates is going to be a dividing line between Iranian influence and European influence eventually.
Right. It is interesting that it's so much at play right now, and it is turning out to be direct confrontation territory between Iran and these other forces. And we've been talking about just the fact that it's not going to be long before you see this shape up in the direction that we expect it to go, that Iran is trying to carve this corridor through Syria as a path to the Mediterranean Sea. What we know about prophecy indicates that is not going to happen. America, as strong as its push may be in the short run, is not going to succeed in knocking Iran out or preventing it from accomplishing its goal of dominance within the region. But a European power will.
Right, definitely. And I think it's interesting, most commentators looking at this, they're putting their money on Iran just because of this, the longevity of the regime there, the fact that they stay around and they have been pushing for 40 years to do this. And so they're not going away. They're happy with a war of attrition against the United States until you get a new president in,
right.
And then the United States withdraws, they have the territory. So commentators right now across the Middle East, astute ones that I follow and I listen to, just looking at the geopolitical factors, they think Iran's going to withstand this temporary hold caused by the United States. Bible prophecy indicates it's not going to happen. In fact, right where they're fighting right now, that's probably going to be the dividing line where their influence stops en route to the Mediterranean.
Fascinating stuff. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about the tensions rising between the United States and Iran. He's writing an article. You can look for that online at thetrumpet.com. It's called The Eastern Syrian Battleground. It'll be up there very shortly. Brent, thanks a lot.
No problem.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
For years, the conventional academic wisdom said the richer a person is, the likelier he is to be selfish, inconsiderate, dishonest. And quite a few studies seem to confirm this, although most of them came from one man. He was a doctoral student in psychology at the University of California, Berkeley. But the media loved the narrative that rich people are rich because they behave selfishly. More recent research casts doubt on the results of those studies and points to a different reality. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Talk about the studies that suggested that rich people are selfish jerks, and then what is it that put those findings in doubt?
Okay, sure. Yeah, as you mentioned, this was conducted primarily by Paul Piff at the University of Berkeley there, and he conducted several laboratory experiments. With one of these, there was a jar labeled just for children, and it had candy in it. And he would prime Berkeley students. It's important to note that Berkeley is famously or perhaps infamously liberal as a school. But he would sort of prime these students who are, if you look at it objectively, the students are fairly homogenous in terms of their wealth. But to create rich ones and poor ones, he would prime them to feel that they were either rich or poor by telling them this is the national average for income. And these were doctored statistics. So by comparison to false national averages, he would make a student either feel that they were poor or rich. And then based on that assumption, try to determine how much candy they would take out of a jar that was supposed to be candy only for children. And so those who were primed to feel rich apparently took more than twice as much candy from the jar. So there are a lot of problems with that kind of experiment. These people were primed to feel a certain way. They're all students who are, you know, 18 right. to 22 years
artificially
old.
Creating a disparity between rich and poor.
Yes. Yeah. And then another of the experiments, they would play Monopoly. But rather than starting the game as you normally do, with a set amount of cash for each player, one of the players would be given twice as much cash to begin with, and three die instead of two to roll with. Mm. And so they were able to move around the board very quickly and buy up all the properties and stack them with houses and motels and all that. And they found that those who started the game with that stacked advantage ended up being very mean in the way that they play it. So they would start to talk really loudly and sort of stomp around loudly on the tray as they were moving their puppy dog around. And at the end of the game, they asked the winner, who is invariably the one that started with the stacked deck and the multiplied cash, why did you win? And this person was almost always likely to say that I had good strategy. I had, I really played my cards well. And then the person who lost would say, well, I mean, the deck was stacked from the beginning. He was given more money than I was. And then he also had some lucky rolls. The loser was more likely to talk about luck. But it was interesting though, that the one who won, despite being given that unfair advantage, often seemed to chalk it up to his, brilliant strategy. So those were a couple of the studies, and then there was another one about job negotiations and how they were more likely to withhold necessary information. Those who were primed once again to feel that they were rich. Anyway, it was a lot of laboratory studies of that kind, and the media just ran crazy with
right.
these. I'm sure people who were reading the news around 2013, 14, 15 probably saw a lot of headlines that said, it's not just you, rich people really are jerks. And now the science proves it. And kind of the implication was rich people are rich because they behave selfishly. You know, if the rest of us lived dishonestly and selfishly, we could be rich too. But at what cost to society? That was kind of the implications of all this. And then, of course, underlying all that is the rich don't really deserve to be rich. We need the government to step in and redistribute wealth. You know,
right.
it really confirmed a lot of long-held suspicions about income inequality. And because of that, the media seemed to love to just publish these studies without necessarily getting into how shaky the science that they were built upon was.
Well, it was, after all, a psychology student from UC Berkeley, so right. It has to be valid.
Yeah.
So somebody started to dig into this and say, well, now, wait a minute, pump the brakes. What really went on in these studies? And is there a way maybe to measure this that is a little more reflective of reality?
Exactly. Yes, there was a behavioral economist, Jan Stoop, who I'm not sure what he set out to do, whether it was to try to just sort of build on Paul Piff's research or whether he was skeptical about it. But he decided to try to conduct field studies, which are different from lab studies, primarily in the respect that the subject or the person being studied doesn't know that they're part of a study.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of problems that come from a person being, well, just knowing that they are a participant in a study. There, it's likely to affect their behavior. Like in that Monopoly game, who knows what those students were thinking, but the one who had all the cash given to them, that's going to, and then they know that there are video cameras on them and scientists in the room, they're observing them. All of those factors are likely to influence their behavior. So anyway, Dr. Jan Stoop, along with a couple of other economists, Dr. Nikos Nikaforakis and Dr. Jim Andriani, they conducted a very elaborate field experiment, which I think is pretty brilliant. And if you just hear the details of how it was conducted and what the results were, to me, it's much more convincing than these people who were primed to mm-hmm. to feel that they were rich or poor, mm-hmm. whether or not they actually were. Basically, what they did, this happened in the Netherlands, where it's much easier than in America to get access to government data regarding household income.
Mm.
If you tell the government, in Amsterdam there, we're scientists, we're being funded by this university, then the government is likely to give you a lot of data that in the US, for example, is more difficult to get a hold of. But based on that government info, Dr. Stoop and his colleagues identified 360 homes, and 180 of these homes were rich, with an average household income of 2.5 million euros per year. And then 180 of them were poor. These were public assistance houses with an average annual income of 25,000 euros.
Hmm.
So pretty big discrepancy.
Massive discrepancy. Yeah.
Yes. And so from October to December of 2013, Stoop's team intentionally misdelivered an envelope to each of these 360 houses. And each envelope contained either 20 euros or 5 euros, along with a little note that seemed to be written from a grandfather to his grandson that just said, "Dear Joost, here is 20 euros for you, grandfather."
Mm-hmm.
Or, "Here's 5 euros for you." And then in a few of the envelopes, they also substituted the cash for what's called a bank transfer card, which is very common in Europe, but it's sort of equivalent to a check in the sense that a bank transfer card can only be cashed or used by the person that it's made out to.
Mm-hmm.
So each of these envelopes listed Joost's real address on the envelope. So the person that was accidentally given it could easily forward the envelope onto the intended recipient. And then each envelope was photoshopped with an authentic looking stamp, complete with a postmark. There was one unusual feature, and that was that the envelopes were semi-transparent, which meant that the erroneous recipient could easily read the card and see the cash or the bank transfer card without having to open the envelope.
Mm.
So that was the only kind of unusual feature, I guess you'd say, of that envelope.
But it was really just a matter of just drop this back into the post box.
That's all you would have to do. Yep. You would take a look at what the envelope was. You'd very easily be able to read, you know, the grandfather's note to his grandson.
Mm-hmm.
You'd see the money. And all a person would have to do is either decide, well, that's their mistake, I'm going to keep this, or I'll just drop this back in the mail. It was a very simple decision that they had to make. So after misdelivering these 360 envelopes, Dr. Stoop's team just had to wait at the correct address for Yeast and see how many of the envelopes came back. And of course, they had everything marked, so they knew which ones had gone to the rich houses, which ones had gone to the poor houses. And the findings were really astounding. Given the research that they had read from Paul Piff and others like him, they expected that the rich people would be less likely to return those envelopes. But what they found was exactly the opposite. About 80% of rich houses forwarded the envelope along to the correct address, and only 40% of the poor households forwarded the envelope along.
It's a big difference.
Quite a big difference. And when they took out the bank transfer cards and looked only at the cash, the gap was even wider. With those, it was 75% of the rich houses that forwarded it along, and only 25% of the poor houses. So Dr. Stoop said one of the big surprises to him was just the fact that these bank transfer cards, these things were worthless to anyone who was not the intended recipient. But even with those bank transfer cards, the poor people were far less likely to do this small altruistic act that they stood nothing to lose from, just, you know, putting it back in the mail. But even there, there was a huge gap where they just said, it's their problem, their mistake, whatever. I can't be bothered to drop this in the mail.
That's amazing. So, what was it that attracted you to this story? I mean, that seems like pretty convincing results. As you said, it seems more convincing than what we saw in those studies from UC Berkeley. But, what was it about this that made you want to look into it more deeply?
Well, I think that I was a little skeptical from the beginning, you know, a couple of years ago when all those headlines from Dr. Piff's study were coming out. Rich people are jerks. They're rich because they're selfish and greedy. I was a little bit skeptical about that just because it contradicts a lot of what the Bible says about generosity and giving and just the way a person will be blessed if he gives more. And if a person is greedy, generally that tends to poverty, that kind of mindset, that kind of outlook on life. There's a proverb, Proverbs 11, 24 through 25. It says, give freely and become more wealthy. Be stingy and lose everything. The generous will prosper. Those who refresh others will themselves be refreshed. So a pretty clear proverb there. It's a little counterintuitive to us because we think, you know, if I want to have a lot of money, I have to hold on to my money. I've got to keep it and not give it away to other people. But the truth is just the opposite. A selfish person typically ends up with little. It's just the way life works over the course of many years. And in order to have much, a person really must give.
So obviously there are greedy rich people, and obviously there are very generous poor people, depending on how you handle your wealth.
Right.
But you're talking about, say, causality working in the other direction, that the person who tends to be more honest and generous and concerned for other people is probably going to be someone who ends up being in a wealthier household. And that virtue would remain, and the person who is just tends to be more selfishly oriented, that he's probably going to end up more impoverished.
Yes, that's right. This field study by Dr. Stoop and his colleagues, it's not all-encompassing. It's not definitive. They're the first to say that many aspects of this multifaceted question remain unanswered. And of course, as you said, it's not difficult to see rich people who do behave selfishly and miserly. And it's not difficult to find poor people who are very generous. But the general principle over the course of enough years and even generations, like certain families may just live with a certain mindset, whether it's one of generosity and giving or a mindset of being more, I don't know, less giving in some ways. And so the Bible principle just says if you do give freely, then you'll become more wealthy. So I thought this was very interesting to see that this field study does seem to back that up.
Very interesting. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about these studies about whether generosity, the tie between generosity and wealth. And he's working on an article on this subject. It's called, at this point, Are Rich People Really Selfish Jerks? You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. It's an interesting subject to look into, Jeremiah. We appreciate you bringing that to us.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Forgive me, but I'm still thinking about Father's Day. This is an exceedingly good tradition. It slips by too quickly. We need to linger on it a bit longer. Among the things I appreciate about Father's Day is the fact that newspapers that are regularly filled with head-shakingly bad news of our day, they all take a moment to feature articles highlighting something not just positive, but also very important. The latest research on the high value of fathers. Take a Wall Street Journal article. This is actually from a few years ago, but it cites several academic sources, and it says that fathers, quote, distinct style of parenting is particularly worth recognition. The way dads tend to interact has long-term benefits for kids, independent of those linked to good mothering. And this article details some of the father's tendencies around children, more rambunctious play, blunter correction, a lack of compassion for the child's scrapes and owies. Check, check, and check in my home. But lo and behold, studies show that these inclinations actually put kids at an advantage. Among the benefits, the article says, improved cognitive skills, fewer behavioral problems among school-aged children, less delinquency among teenage boys, and fewer psychological problems in young women. Now, it's not that mom's parenting style doesn't work as well, but it's more effective when it's complemented and balanced by dad's approach. I love that. Bravo. Anything that celebrates the family as it was designed is worth applauding in my book. I find it remarkable that even after decades of an aggressive effort to paint dad as irrelevant in the home, the stubborn common sense fact remains that the family is far better off when dad is there and when he's engaged. Liberated women have tried to push them aside. Selfish men have embraced the erroneous self-serving notion that their children don't need them. But time and again, the facts bear out that dad has a central, vital role that he ought not abdicate. How well do you understand how important your role as a father is? Do you know what God requires of you? The role that God put you in as a dad, it's bigger than you are. It's not a prize, it's a tool. And you have to see what God wants to accomplish with it. If you use it the right way, you can really be a blessing in the life of your family and the lives of your children. I would say that the aspect of fatherhood that is least understood by modern society is the importance of dad being an authority in the life of his children. A father should lead his home with loving leadership. Now, that statement, of course, is something that arouses hostility from a lot of intellectuals and politicians and regular folks. And as a result, a lot of men don't know how to properly establish authority in their own household. They haven't seen it done. They hear that it's just evil by its very nature. They're not even sure they should do it because society around them seethes at even the thought of it. You know what? That's a major reason why society is as deeply troubled as it is. As a man, you need to clear your mind of society's erroneous biases and agendas and learn to view parental authority the way the creator of parents and children and family views authority. The fifth commandment says, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Modern child-rearing tends to focus on establishing rapport with children and doing activities together and even building a friendship. Now, if that's your entire approach toward your children, you're going to have serious problems. The foundation of the relationship with your children must include establishing your authority. You must teach your children to respect your office as a father. The fifth commandment establishes God's government in your home. It places parents in authority over children. Now, of course, even though it's specifically directed at children, we parents have to be the ones to train and instruct our children to honor us and then enforce that command. The person who must make sure that that commandment is enforced in your family is you. You have to learn how to administer your authority and do it with affection and warmth and encouragement and instruction and also correction and discipline. These are all facets of God's love, and they should all flow from the authority that God has given you as a father. You've got to pray for his help in order to get the balance right. But if you do it the right way, you allow God to bless your family through you. You're using your role as a father in a way that it really is a gift to your family, the way that God intends it to be. Father's Day is a terrific reminder of the beauty and the effectiveness in the design of the family. Forget the father haters. Men, we have a job to do. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I really want to thank my guests on the program today, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Steve Herkus. And I'll leave you with this thought from Aesop. Gratitude is the sign of noble souls. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.